I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran. And this is Radio versus the Martians. It's almost like that's kind of a role that now that in 2023 we've seen it, that I think that Dave Bautista should have had.
Yeah, Dave Bautista.
Where your dad is this giant monster of a guy who's so totally masculine, but none of his strengths, his external strengths, are what is required of this situation.
Yeah.
Where he needs to have internal strength, emotional strength.
Okay, have you seen Knock at the Cabin? It's a Shyamalan movie, but it's like a good Shyamalan movie.
Nope. I don't think I've seen a Shyamalan movie since The Happening. I think I gave
Ooh,
up.
that was rough.
The Happening has all of the earmarks of a last straw movie that, for me, it was kind of different. Have you watched any of The American Office?
Oh, God. I've seen half of the parkour episode.
Okay. So I was... And I've talked about this on the show before. I was a long-time hardcore fanboy of M. Night Shyamalan.
Mm-hmm.
And I was all in. And as his movies got less good, I'm trying to be diplomatic, I would get, in my early 20s, more and more defensive about them. And The Happening was the movie where all of that crumbled, and I just learned to enjoy what they were. Rather than try to argue around them or try to,
there's a secret genius, right?
Yeah, I think I still, even at his worst, I really like that Shyamalan is out there doing his thing, even when the movie doesn't turn out well, because he's a guy who always takes big swings, and if it doesn't land, it's still unlike anything else out there. And I hate to keep shitting on it, but in this sort of Disney-fied, Marvelized world where there's kind of a paint-by-numbers template that even visionary directors have to, like a Sam Raimi barely gets to Sam Raimi in his Sam Raimi movie for Disney, and Shyamalan movies can't feel like anything but Shyamalan.
Yeah, he's swinging big.
Yeah. And I just want more movies that feel like the artistic expression of a particular person.
I can respect that. I was deep into the Marvel stuff for a while. And then, you know, Endgame feels like it should be an end. And
yes.
It's like, are you fucking kidding? I have to watch more of this? Like...
It feels like we've been watching a 6-movie epilogue.
Yeah.
It's like, well, we had the big conclusion. Why are we still going?
Yeah, it's like the issue with like British television is so good because at some point it knows to just stop and do something else.
It knows to quit.
And American movies are now being like American television, where it's like you don't have a plan for Lost, but you're by God gonna keep making it. So
the Shyamalan is interesting because I would have thought, oh, him doing, was it Glass, was the one that was like the third of two other movies to try to make.
Yeah, he was doing
make
the Unbreakable...
a shared universe kind of. And that, which of course is obviously like a nod to, oh, it'll just be like Marvel. But now he, you know, he makes his movies on his own budget. He's on his own dime. So he's not, doesn't have to get money from Tencent. He doesn't have to get money from Warners or Annapurna or anyone else.
He doesn't have to worry about getting $100 million at the box office because his movies don't cost $100 million.
He can, if he gets $25 million at the box office, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And he gets to do another one.
Apparently he's really fun to work for because he only makes you work 9 to 5.
Oh.
Yeah. So a lot of people keep working for M. Night Shyamalan.
He shoots in Pennsylvania. Where is it?
It is in Philly. I believe in Pennsylvania.
He shoots in Pennsylvania.
He films within driving distance of his house. And I like that he found that niche for himself. But anyways, his most recent movie, Knock at the Cabin, feels like the moment where we all acknowledge that of all of the professional wrestlers who have become actors, that Dave Bautista is head and shoulders, very large head and shoulders, above everybody else. That he has fulfilled the prophecy that Dwayne Johnson has disappointed us in.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny, you mentioned about Dave Bautista should have had that role in Maggie. And I was thinking, like, could you put Jason Statham, Dwayne Johnson, like any of the other big guys.
Put The Rock in it.
No, no. And you can't. And like when it comes to like the beefy dudes who can act, yeah, that's a one name list. So
it's very hard because you those actors get notoriety because of how they look and secondarily how they talk. And usually not how well they emote.
Yeah.
Which is still, that's what is interesting about it is you project Arnold forward 40 years mm-hmm. in his movie career, and he can do Maggie when you see Hercules in New York at the beginning, and then you see him do Maggie, you're like, oh, this guy put a lot of work over his life to actually become an actor, a real actor.
Yeah, that he's pushed himself. And I think Dave Bautista's arc for that has been much faster. And I think that the thing that separates him from Dwayne Johnson is the ambition. There was an interview I saw that Dave Bautista gave where he was talking about how he first got cast for Guardians of the Galaxy, and he said he was talking to the woman who was a casting director who cast him, and she asked him, do you know Lee Pace? And he's like, well, no, I haven't met him. And Lee Pace plays the bad guy in the first one. And she goes, oh, he's amazing. He can do anything. And Dave Bautista's like, I want somebody to talk about me that way someday.
Wow.
That he wants to be somebody that he can throw into, you know, a comedy, you know, like a romance movie, an action, sci-fi, whatever you need, he can do it. And I think he specifically chooses roles based on him stretching his muscles, so to speak, and doing interesting things. Like, I remember seeing him at the beginning of Blade Runner 2049 and going, holy shit, this guy's amazing. And a lot of it is a willingness to go small, a willingness to go subtle and quiet, and to use his massive size to kind of undermine the sort of expectations you have and just go, no, what if this guy who was built as a combat unit just wanted to be a quiet moisture farmer and had this religious experience in his life, predating the events of the movie, and how that would change him. And there's something kind of quiet and kind and sad about him.
And also the idea that hit that character. Have you seen Blade Runner 2049?
No.
No, you haven't.
Sadly.
He's a thing that The Rock wouldn't do now, which is, I'm a character in this movie and I'm just going to have the shit beaten out of me by the protagonist.
By Ryan Gosling.
Right, by a smaller guy who's the protagonist. The ego on some of the sort of the bigger wrestlers is like, well, I'm going to be that guy. I'm always going to be top billed. I'm going to be the guy that counts the number of punches that I take, you know, because I always want to give more than I take.
I've heard that both The Rock and Vin Diesel have a thing in their contract that they're not allowed to lose a fight.
Yeah,
I wouldn't
in their
doubt
movies.
It. I wouldn't doubt it.
And I don't see Dave Bautista putting that, like, yeah.
No.
Well, I think he understands this is a collaborative storytelling medium. And the same thing with wrestling. I think wrestling probably has this sort of dog-eat-dog attitude. If you get beaten up too much, you lose your credibility. And then people stop casting you to win fights after a while. But I think a lot of them carry that over. And this sort of fear that I'm going to be seen as weak. Because then if I just get... This is actually kind of an Al Pacino monologue from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Is, you know, when he's talking about DiCaprio's character, and he's like, oh, you play a bad guy in that new pilot? Oh, well, you know, that's what happens to people at the end of their career. You're not going to be the hero anymore. The young upcoming actor beats the shit out of you. You know, in the new thing, it's like, oh, look at that. It's, you know, it's Rick Dalton. He's getting beat up by this guy on this show. And he's like, and who's next? Who's going to kick your ass next? Batman and Robin? And it just kind of hits him. And I think Dave Bautista's one of those guys who's like, of course, because I'm the bad guy. And that's the job of the bad guy. And I think you look at the place that Dwayne Johnson goes, and I just go, what happened? You know, because it felt like he has undeniable charisma to this day, but I watch interviews with Dwayne Johnson, and everything, the only way I can describe it is it feels like when a politician runs for president and everything, even the laughs they give to the interviewer's question, just feel practiced, where everything feels like it feels like it's been put through a focus test. And he's like, I am backwards working the whatever formula it is to become this massive star. And then art just falls out of the equation. It isn't.
There's a brand now.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that was a thing. And there was a quote that I found in the Onion's AV Club that just completely blew my mind as it goes to Dwayne Johnson. And I'm going to try to bring it up here. The quote, this is from the AV Club. Quote, there's a feeling in F9 that Cena is here to replace Dwayne The Rock Johnson, a once promising actor who spent the last decade over-calculating and under-delivering, armed with contractual stipulations regarding how many times he can be punched on screen. The Rock has settled into his persona as a tan t-shirt enthusiast too quickly. There are no stakes for The Rock because he doesn't let the audience see him fail. When we see Johnson, whether it be on the red carpet or in Jungle Cruise, it's always through a thick film of corporate synergy. He'll show up, rattle off a couple of gravelly one-liners, plug his tequila, and move on to the next step and repeat.
It's just so funny. You could have taken that. You could have taken some of the nouns and verbs out of that, or the nouns out of it, and you could have been, oh, well, this is an Arnold Schwarzenegger thing, right? Mm-hmm. In like Last Action Hero, you know, mid-90s peak Arnold Schwarzenegger. It could be that. You could just be like,
but I don't think Arnold
He's showing up to plug, you know, Hollywood Cafe. What is it? Hollywood?
Oh, the Planet Hollywood.
Planet Hollywood. And he's just going to have these cameo lines in this movie, and that's it. That's all he is.
Well, I don't think Arnold ever. I mean, yeah, he's happy to pitch for things. I mean, he appeared with like a strange Japanese commercial. Those are great to look up if you've never seen them. Yes. If you want to see Hulk Hogan on like a mattress commercial singing the days of the week as lyrics. It makes no sense, but I guarantee you that dude got paid a shit ton of money. Arnold never felt as cynically like a walking sentient brand the way that Dwayne Johnson does.
Even though he became a brand.
But I think
and it became the same way where you, when you talk about, oh, I saw the Arnold movie and the character's name was Arnold.
Yeah.
Arnold in this movie does XYZ. He's not a John Matrix or a whatever.
But I don't see that. I don't think Arnold would ever worry about how many times he gets punched in a movie. I think I won the fight at the end. Indiana Jones gets a shit kicked out of him like 65% of the time in fights. And it doesn't make you dislike him more. Harrison Ford fails a lot in his action roles. I mean, Han Solo is an amazing pilot, but the fun thing to watch is how many other things he's bad at. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of endearing watching him try to hotwire a door and fail, try to talk his way out of stormtroopers coming over the radio and fail.
Yeah. Well, and you talk about like the concept of like failure or being the bad guy or losing. And it's like, I don't know that this is true. I don't know if this is like a sort of generational issue or what, but it's like my first big conception of Arnold as an actor is The Terminator. And I don't think that's an uncommon experience. A movie wherein he is the bad guy and loses.
Yeah.
Right.
And so if that's how you make it big, if that's what sort of establishes you as the dude, you're there to be the threat and then be overcome. You know, he's clearly not afraid to be shown losing. The Rock has not had that experience yet where defeat in a film, in a narrative, can actually still work.
Real vulnerability, right?
Yeah.
Show some real vulnerability.
And I think Dwayne Johnson's career artistically, I mean, he's going to be a big, massive star no matter what we do. But so many of his movies feel so forgettable because they just feel like you could plug almost anyone into that role that I don't know. I don't know what it is. I think he feels more like a disappointment where I look at, say, John Cena. John Cena's career started that way, where he's playing a lot of these bland military characters that could be just about anyone, rattling off quasi Tommy Lee Jones dialogue. But then on Peacemaker, you have scenes where he's like hitting himself in the face and being horribly insecure and crying in his trailer. Or, you know, moments where he's like douchey or pathetic or strange. And I don't see Dwayne Johnson being game to do things like that in a role. Where I look at John Cena, again, is way more game to try new things and to be a goofball in something. Or to be a douchebag or an asshole. Or to get his ass kicked in something. And, you know, we're play acting. This is a story. And you can't constantly worry about whether your character wins or loses fights. you know, you just, you do as well as you can to serve the story. And
it's so funny to me how this conversation, like, if you enter into it halfway through, are we talking about movies or professional wrestling?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's, yeah, it's a very similar kind of thing. And I think wrestling just takes those things and puts them right out in the open, where people openly argue about losing their spot, you know, and they're afraid that the state of their career now portends the state of their career forever. So you have to do something, and you refuse to be giving. You refuse to collaborate. You refuse to let other people shine. And the thing is, when people are ultimately selfish making collaborative art, it makes worse art. You know, I don't want to see a movie where, you know, it's supposed to be an action film, which is, if Dwayne Johnson is your main character, if Vin Diesel is your main character, and I can never see them fail, why should I get invested in the stakes? Why should I feel like it's a big deal when they do eventually win?
It's almost the same problem as like superhero movies. Yeah. It's hard to see stakes, but instead of plot armor, you've got contract armor.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, his he originally was approached to play Captain Marvel, Shazam. And I think he would have been a lot more interesting in that kind of role, which is, you know, Dwayne Johnson playing an adult body that has a kid's brain in it.
Oh, he'd be adorable at that.
I think he would be great. Plus, he's this big, muscly guy who could be like, he's like a 12-year-old kid pretending to be an adult. I think that could be a lot of fun. But I think he got really into playing this anti-hero with Black Adam. And then, I don't know, it just got built up so long that for a long time, I just assumed that movie was never coming out. I just go...
Don't you mean the highest grossing movie of all time?
Oh, you mean...
Isn't that what he said?
Oh, it turns out that the hierarchy of power in the DC universe is remarkably consistent. It did not change. he was
like leaking private details of box office numbers on one of his social media sites to prove that it was not a flop, because it was, his ego was being bruised by the fact that people were saying, oh my god, it's such a big flop, and he's like, no, it's made more than biggest opening in the history of movies.
Hollywood accounting is already a really shady endeavor already, but I mean, it just, I don't even know how you judge what something is a flop or a success, because there's all this money that goes into promotion that doesn't get counted as part of the budget. And
that's so tender of an ego that, like, again, come halfway into that conversation, are we talking about Black Adam, or are we talking about Morbius?
Yeah. God, Morbius is like the saddest thing to me, because suits need to stop acting like they can take an internet meme and exploit it for profit, because it always bites them in the ass. They don't understand what it is, and they don't understand what the joke at the heart of It's Morbin Time and all that stuff was. The whole joke is, this movie looks bad and I don't want to see it, and we're repurposing it ironically to pretend it's the greatest thing ever. None of those people saw the movie, but they would take clips from the commercials and repurpose that into something. The whole joke is that this movie doesn't look good. And they, oh my God, the memes got them to re-release a movie so that it could flop twice. And it just felt like at that point, the people on the internet was, hey, everybody, let's keep doing this and let's see if we can make it flop three times. But it's like, Morbius is not a good movie. I did see it.
The funny thing is that it's not going to affect Jared Leto's career whatsoever.
No.
He just always, he'll just slide into doing another movie where he's the weirdest character in the movie. It's fine.
It's so depressing because he's so boring in Morbius.
Right.
He's so unbelievably boring.
And he's so fun in House of Gucci. Like, you're just like, okay, give him roles. Don't make him try to be a Tobey Maguire or whoever the fuck they were trying to make him in that. Just give him roles where he's the weirdo.
He seems to like playing the weirdo. Have you seen House of Gucci?
I have not.
He basically plays a mix between Luigi Mario and Fredo Corleone. It's insane.
With a real, real thick makeup on, so you can't even recognize
him. He's almost like a character that Andy Kaufman might play. It's so absurdly weird, and the costumes that he has, he feels like he's from a different movie and has snuck into this biopic, and they're just like, I guess we just act around him. And he's just... It's so fucking strange.
That's amazing. Dave and I went out to, we took our niece to Cirque du Soleil last weekend.
Nice.
And then afterwards we ended up at this Italian restaurant where we were very certain that the owner, he was also acting as like a waiter and host and filling many roles. He was a Cirque du Soleil clown that had escaped and like decided to come serve us dinner. It was wow. Like he just... It was the most surreal experience. And so as you're explaining Fredo Corleone and Luigi, like that's sort of what I'm envisioning is escaped Cirque du Soleil clown.
It's weird because you wonder if somebody's
he's able to break his ankle shackles and climb out through a vent and got away.
It's just so bizarre where it's like, are you performing right now or is this you? Or have you lost track?
This is a open question. If you were to likely be at a restaurant where you're going to run into a server who is basically going to be a character, not the person, but like a real actual character, is the number one cuisine that's likely to be an Italian restaurant? Because I feel like with Italian restaurants, you already have a baked-in stereotype. You already have, like, the super bubbly, the Italian guy is super friendly.
It's a spicy meatball.
Yeah, you've already got that.
Which to me says that the guy's not really Italian.
No, of course not.
But it's a me, you know? It's like
But I can think of another, you know, like, maybe a Mexican restaurant, but then again, it would be pretty offensive to do like a peppy lip.
That gets you canceled.
I think Speedy Gonzalez voice with a sombrero.
It's not Italian. It's got to be Greek or one of those Italian Greek fusion. Yeah,
that would be obnoxious. It'd be like you're doing My Big Fat Greek Wedding,
mm-hmm.
Restaurant.
I think we can put it under the umbrella of Balky accent. That you are Fez from that 70s show. You are Andy Kaufman in Taxi. You are from an ill-defined European-ish country that has your Borat. You're from a place that doesn't really exist. And it sort of goes, foreign guy. He's exuberant. He wants to give you a food. And you don't really know how to do it. You're like, is this guy making fun? Is this guy fucking with me? What's going on here?
Now, I have to ask you, Carol, when he started turning on the charm, when you knew that like it was going down, that this was not going to be a regular interaction, were you like, I'm immediately tired of it? Or was it enough that you were curious as to how far he was going to take it?
It was a goddamn delight.
Okay, good. Because I get so fucking uncomfortable when I see the strangers that are trying to do a thing.
Yeah.
And then he'd be like, I don't want to stand here and watch you just completely faceplant doing this thing.
No, it was a tiny little restaurant and he's doing his act at full volume the entire
mm-hmm,
time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also like, I love my niece dearly. She is 13 years old. And I don't see her often enough for us to be completely at ease. I am good with the youths, but there's still a little like formality, perhaps. And so to have this like completely ludicrous human being just in the place where the three of us can make eye contact and start giggling really helped break the ice. Like
I
would take someone there as a first date to sort of judge compatibility, honestly.
It's starting to sound like one of those shows you go to, like there's one of them where the performer is a nun and they treat you like the class, so there's some kind of audience give and take.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, but it's a restaurant, and
yes,
this guy's the owner, and he may or may not be playing one of Peter Parker's landlords. And you just don't know what's going on.
I'm really not into restaurant gimmicks. I'm not like I said, it embarrasses me. I've never been to a Chuck E. Cheese. I think it would probably be...
Is that the ultimate gimmick restaurant?
It's so ultimate gimmick restaurant. I will say, I would be curious once, but only once, to try the Eating in the Dark restaurant.
Mm.
You know, where the whole thing is to enhance your...
I believe that's called a movie theater.
Yes. No, it's where you like, there's an ante room that you gather, and then you all put on blindfolds, and then the servers sort of carefully walk you into this dark room.
And you reach your hand into the peeled grapes.
Yes. And then the idea is that you, like, you're in this room with, you know, 25, 30, 40 strangers, and you've already ordered your food, and you get the food in front of you, and because you don't have any other distractions other than the sound, your sense of smell and your sense of taste are heightened.
I grew up with a sibling, and I cannot trust that scenario. All I can think of is that they're laughing at me behind a screen because they did something to my food.
Or you're a hidden camera show, right?
Oh, yeah.
Something hidden camera for sure. Is going to happen. Someone's going to pop out with a military grade night vision goggles and start fucking with you.
They replaced my apple with an onion or something. I mean, this is some like next level, like Stanford prison experiment.
Someone
shit.
Standing in the dark next to me doing a silent little sibling. I'm not touching you. Just no.
Man, No.
It's got to be a reputable midnight. What do they call these things? Blind eating.
I don't know even what reputable is. If it's that gimmicky, it's probably needlessly expensive.
No, I'm sure it's expensive.
There's a whole ecosystem of fancy but ultimately empty experience restaurants for gullible rich people, and this just feels like one of those. And those are the restaurants where you're basically tricking somebody. You just have a sprinkling of like chocolate powder and what looks like a smear of mustard in a certain shape, and then like a tiny piece of salmon, and you charge them like $1,000 for it. And it just feels like, you know, I mean, if you can scam rich people like that, hey, go to it.
I think
they have more than they can spend.
I think there's like a glass half empty, glass half full way to look at it, because in some senses, the culinary, the aesthetic experience of eating something that is done where the ingredients are amazing, the people who've made it are true professionals, and they know how to make this kind of thing that you probably won't ever have again, it would be worth spending 4 or 5 or 6 times what you would pay for it if it's the one really amazing, you know, experience you're going to have once in every 5 years. That's different than it being like, well, I go to this one fancy ass restaurant every weekend, and they charge $100 for the flounder.
But I
like,
wonder how much
of
that
see
is
the difference.
How much of that is psychosomatic? That it's great because you're told that it's great. I mean, didn't Payless Shoe Source do one of those like things a while back where they created this like trendy upscale fake shoe store that it had a name like Payless, but it was spelt look French-ish, and they got a bunch of like influencers to pay like $500 for $50 shoes and shit.
Oh,
like
God.
That I remember seeing some viral video that the Payless Corporation did for that, and I appreciate that kind of marketing, but I just go, you know, anyone who's willing to spend this much money on something kind of deserves to have their food spat in. And I just think that if I'm participating in that, then I'm absolutely eating somebody's spit, and I deserve it because I could.
I don't know. You want the tips. Isn't that what we learned from Triangle of Sadness? Is that the reason you're willing to put up with insufferable rich people is on the slight chance that you might get a huge ass tip?
The slight chance.
Yes.
Yeah. Rich people are the cheapest motherfuckers in the world. Have you been to one of their garage sales? Half of the shit is broken. And they do not treat their stuff well. But again, it's that idea that, oh, of course I'm going to charge $500 for this broken lamp. I mean, that's the kind of bullshit. And I just go, you know.
I think we need to plunder the Radio versus the Martians war chest. And we need to get you to go to like $1,000 a plate dinner, Mike, and see if it really lives up or lives down to your expectations.
I mean, I would, if you're going to give me that much money that it would cost a meal, I would rather just get the equivalent of that meal for 5% of the price and then just give the rest to a homeless shelter. Because that's the sort of stuff where it's a kind of consumption that is expensive for the sake of being expensive, yeah. Like buying Kanye $75 white t-shirt. Where it's just like a status symbol, and all it really is bragging about what a gullible prick you are.
I've done a $100 a plate meal for like, you know, anniversary, something very, very special like that. And it's like, this was food. It was fine. I have cooked both better and worse than this in my life. And mostly I feel like I'm paying for the ambiance and the experience. If we're doing $1,000 a plate, there's an apocalypse on. That is not like a symbol of safety and abundance to my brain.
But Mike is right, that when you reach that level, reach the level of like, I mean, inflation has changed stuff. So I would say, you know, you go to like Denny's and things, you know, a hamburger is like $15. But I mean, once you get where an entree is north of $100 or $150 or something, you really are just paying for the prestige of being in a place where things are expensive. If there's, you can't make the quality of ingredients that much more, you know, quality by adding $500 to the cost of the...
Yeah. There's a limit to how good a hamburger can get.
Yes.
And it probably tops out at like $25.
We could put some gold flakes in it, though, Mike.
Oh, God, I want to...
How does that improve... No.
See, at that point, I would...
I want gold flakes on my Domino's pizza.
Oh, my God. See, when
my Crunchwrap Supreme with a little bit of sprinkled platinum on top. Right?
It's like, can I just scrape that off the top? Can I have my gold on the side, please? Because... The alternative is this thing is going down my toilet, and it just feels so awful. I mean, that's the kind of thing where it's like lighting your cigar with a $50 bill
right. You've
lit. It's just the kind of performative consumption that makes me want to like prop open the back door so a group of like Maoist revolutionaries can kick the door in and rob everybody.
Is that what you're constantly afraid of, is if you're ever in a situation where you're in too fancy of a restaurant, that will be the time
where
the Marxists will come in and
shoot
you against the wall. They'll be like, get that guy up against the wall, you pig.
Yeah, seriously. I would deserve it. I'm like, fuck, I'm here. Do me first so it scares the rest of them. It makes me angry. It's the sort of thing where if I participate in this, I will not be able to like myself. There's a point at which if I am wasting money on that scale for something that I can give the exact same experience, but it isn't as pretentious, then it just feels like I just got robbed. That's the kind of shit by another rich asshole who owns the restaurant that this fancy... It feels like we're just getting into the plot of The Menu, which is a great movie, by the way. Have you seen it?
I don't know that I've seen it.
Well worth checking out.
Okay.
But
you were talking about it. It reminded me, there's a Michael Haneke, who's a German director who always makes... He makes the type of movies that make people uncomfortable. That's sort of his thing. And he's got like a mid-80s movie. I think it's called Australia or Down South or something. But the plot of the movie essentially is there's this family and it looks like they're packing up to do everything. Like they're doing all this motion of being like, okay, this family's going to move away from Germany or wherever the hell it takes place. And they're going to leave and they're going to move to emigrate to another country. And so you're seeing all these weird things happening, all this turmoil, people packing up. And then stranger things start happening, like they're ordering this catering, this giant dinner, and they're all eating it. And there's just so much left over. You don't know what's happening. And then it slowly becomes clear that what they're doing is this family and their daughter are preparing themselves to commit suicide together. Mm. And there is a scene. So, of course, it's about... There's like a certain point in time, they're like, well, fuck it, then we're going to fuck up our house. And they just start breaking shit, right? Because like, what are we going to do? There's a scene where the dad, who's the main character, goes to withdraw all of the money out of his bank account. And it's just a close up of a toilet. And it's actual, it's not euros, it's actual Deutschmarks being ripped in half and flushed down the toilet. Real Deutschmarks.
What movie did, when year did this come out?
It's like 1985.
Okay, like, so those are still worth something.
Right, yeah. No, yeah, but like, you know, probably on the, I don't remember, it was probably on the order of like $20,000, where a filmmaker, instead of being like, well, we're going to pay the prop guy to print out this, that you would still have the effect of a feeling of like, oh, these people are literally flushing money down the toilet because it doesn't mean anything to them. They actually did take real currency and for the purpose of this movie. And the funny thing is that it's a thing that you stop worrying about how weird it is for the characters, and then you're worried about for yourself and for the rest of the world.
Well,
you're just like, what the fuck am I watching?
I just think that there are members of the crew that would probably really like that money. And that's the part I can't help but think about. When you have that kind of consumption, especially when it isn't even apparently pleasurable. It's just a thing that I'm showing off because it's supposed to reflect on me. And this is something that pops up in both Triangle of Sadness.
Is that any better or worse than just... I understand Michael Haneke's trying to make a point about the audience and their relationship to it. And apparently at the festival that it premiered, there was like walkouts because people just could not stand watching it. Is that all that much worse, though, than just having like a Ant-Man Quantumania cost $200 million when it's a movie that easily could have cost $50 million.
Well, I think the difference there is that the cost of $200,000, theoretically, that's people's jobs.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, right. Which is way different than like literal toilet money. Like that's $20,000 that didn't go to like a better sound guy or whatever. The prop guy, for instance.
Well, maybe that money
and
was
in 1985, paid. That's probably a year's salary for some people.
Maybe that money would just go to the plumber so he'd unstop that drain.
Oh, he should keep it. I don't think they have the salvage rights when you're a plumber that you get to keep what you find. Most of it would not be something you want.
Hey, ask Mario. He's rescuing gold coins from the sewer all the time.
Yeah, I just... But I was just thinking about, like, the sort of... There are scenes in both Triangle of Sadness and The Menu where very rich people are excited about plates of food that are set in front of them that do not look fun to eat, that don't look like they taste good, that they don't look filling, but they're a status symbol and a way to show off that you were here and you put this thing in your head. Like, there's a plate in Triangle of Sadness because all of these rich people who are absolute monsters all have different things. They're not all eating the same thing. And one guy has a plate that is just this strange, clear gelatin in a small mountain, and it looks like parsley sprinkled on top of it. And I have no fucking clue what that is, but I guarantee you he paid way too much for it. He doesn't appreciate it, but he will brag about having had it at the place he had it. And for what purpose if you don't even probably enjoy it that much? And The Menu even has a lot of these moments where it's like, oh, this thing is more performance art than meal. There's this giant piece of driftwood or something on your plate with all this stuff sprinkled around it, and it's got all, there's eatable things on it, and it's that whole, ooh, we're eating the ocean. And it's like, yeah, you made an artistic expression of yourself, but this could have just been a sculpture. It's not really a meal, and it doesn't seem like it would taste good or be filling.
Yeah, I wonder, because I think the concept of you're paying too much for this experience and you don't even seem to enjoy it, you just want to tell the story. Like, that's got to be true of so many things. Climbing Mount Everest comes to mind, but it's also one of those, like, who am I to judge? Like, someone thinks my hobbies, I'm going to spend that much money to go to sports all the times. Have you watched a soccer game? Actually, yes. And I do really thoroughly enjoy it, but I understand why it's not enjoyable to other people and they can't fathom what I would see in it. But I think there's something about food that feels so like intimate, a survival need, that it just like I'm, it's harder to just be blasé about like, oh, okay, if that's how you want to spend your money and find your enjoyment, then I guess good on you, you know?
It also turns to shit, too. So
yes, that's the
other thing. That's the weird thing about, yeah, I mean, you do a lottery ticket, you know, scratch off a lottery ticket and you lose, you make a little bit of trash or whatever, but food literally just turns to human shit.
Yeah, but then so. It doesn't, I think it's one thing if you go to, like, the World Cup and you have the big, it's like making the soccer experience as big as possible, but there is no version of that for eating that is going to be worth that same amount equivalent of money, because there's a certain point where really what you're paying for is almost like, it's like one of those like escape room experiences, except it's a meal where you're given this weird puzzle or something. And it's like, but it's that the World Cup, you know, celebrity thing that you're getting, you're still watching a real soccer game. You're watching the same soccer game that everyone else in the cheap seats is watching. You just have better food and a giant wall made out of glass that you have as your screen that you get to watch it from. But when you're eating food that isn't really food, it doesn't really taste good, and it's more about feeling like I solved one of those mystery puzzle games rather than I ate something filling that tasted good. It's not even serving the purpose of food at that point. And that's the stuff where I'm just like, I don't feel bad about rich people being scammed, but I think about all the ways that they would much rather hoard their money and spend it on this than pay their employees even a dollar more per hour.
Yeah.
And all I can think about is, man, you could not have this bullshit experience and somebody wouldn't be homeless right now. And it's like, again, putting the wedge in the back door and praying for Maoist revolutionaries. So it's like, I just go, man, I wonder if they're recruiting. I mean, it's just, it just gets so fucking tiring of seeing people do that when I see more and more tents and RVs on the side of the road. And I think about that giant pile of clear gelatin with parsley on it that the dude in Triangle of Sadness is eating and just going, Jesus Christ, that probably cost as much as a small car.
Yeah, that's someone's rent for like 6 months.
Radio vs. the Martians is hosted by Mike Gillis and Casey Doran. This podcast is recorded in beautiful Val Verde in Seattle, Washington. Our chief engineer is Casey Doran, and our editor is Mike Gillis. Our original theme music is written and performed by James Wetzel. Special thanks to Sam Mulvey, Rob Kelly, James Wetzel, Paul Rue, Tobias Panshin, Scott Kramer, Kyle Hepworth, and Todd Maxfield Matsumoto. Please take the time to rate and review our show on iTunes and Stitcher, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And if you'd like to support the show financially, please consider becoming one of our Patreon subscribers. Even just a dollar a month gives you access to exclusive episodes. And you can always find us online at radioversusthemartians.com.